It looks like we've got everybody on board. Let me call this to order. We're entertaining docket number 78513, Mickelson versus State. And counsel, as you can see here, we've got everybody remote. We've got Justice Kadish in the Las Vegas courtroom. We've got Justice Hardesty in his own private courtroom. And I'm happy to see you here in Carson City. So with that, we'll call.
So counsel are present there in the courtroom, Justice Perigary?
Yes. Justice Kadish, can you not see?
Well, I assume the camera will go to them when they're speaking, but I don't see them right
so.
At this
Jason,
moment.
Are we okay with that? You got all the cameras?
Yeah, I'll show her right here.
All right.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay, wonderful.
Thank you.
All right, we'll call this to order. Mr. Soto, if you'd like to come up, and would you like to reserve any time?
I would like to reserve 2 minutes. May I speak without the mask, or how do you prefer?
Yes, we're distanced enough, so yes.
Good morning, Justices. It's a pleasure to be before you. And for the record, I'm Sally DeSoto from the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Mickelson on this direct appeal. I'm going to start with the Fifth Amendment issue, which deals with whether officers should have advised Mr. Mickelson of his right prior to requesting the passcode to his phone. And officers did not read Mr. Mickelson his rights because they had concluded that he had already verbally requested counsel. The United States Supreme Court stated in Fisher v. United States that in order for statements to be protected, they must be testimonial. And we contend that the passcode is testimonial. In Doe v. United States, the Supreme Court further defined testimonial in a footnote, and that language is applicable to this case. The court compared testimonial versus testimonial language to an analogy of requesting the key to the strong box versus the combination to the safe. The government can ask for the key. It is like requiring physical evidence such as fingerprints, blood, voice analysis, something similar like that, whereas the passcode comes out of somebody's mind, so it's more akin to requesting the combination to the safe. And although we have not addressed the issue in the state, whether Miranda applies to passcodes, there is a number of cases from other jurisdictions that have fully or partially address this issue.
Ms. DeSoto, can I ask you, there was a body cam footage that recorded the passcode, is that correct?
Yes.
How does that figure into your analysis?
Well, the state claims that that's sort of, they claim that that was, you know.
Inevitable discovery?
Yes, inevitable discovery. They compared it to the cases that were, where they did the inventory searches after a legal arrest. I could not find any cases that address that specifically. The closest I could come was wiretap cases, where they definitely needed a warrant before they could use something that was taped without the other's knowledge. And we kind of contend that that he was not aware that he was being taped at that point, as well as the fact that he'd already given them the passcode.
Analogous to almost analogous to a plain sight.
It could be. I mean, yeah. To me, he's already given him. He'd already requested the code. He'd already given it to him. So I don't think that it was that he was concerned about whether it was right or wrong at that point. He still hadn't been advised of his rights. Okay. So I feel that even the taping kind of fell in line with the other request for the passcode.
Ms. DeSoto, apologize. So this is okay. Justice Kadish.
Yes.
Hi. So the Miranda rights only need to be given if he was going to be interrogated. So in what? It's my understanding the context here is they were saying, you know, they wanted to put it in airplane mode and asked for the code for that purpose, and that it wasn't like a whole series of questions. It was just asking for the code. So how does that fit into the definition of what an interrogation is? If they weren't asking about about the alleged crime or anything like that.
Well, and according to the cases, they were also asking so they could get into the phone when they received a warrant. But according to the cases, anything that comes out of a person's mind is considered sort of interrogation. So if they're requesting this information and it's within his mind, then that's testimonial evidence. And some of the cases that there was a case that's unpublished out of the Northern District of California called United States v. Maffei, and they analyzed that testimonial versus non-testimonial language in the compelled disclosure of biometric passcodes versus verbal passcodes, and they held that the biometric is more akin to the key to the lockbox, where it's, you know, evidence that you know, their facial recognition or their thumb is more sort of a structural evidence kind of thing, whereas the verbal passcode comes out of the mind, and that can't be compelled. And the state also, they had mentioned a case that came out of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania that held that that the passcode was not testimonial. But 2 years later, in 2019, they overturned that case by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, which held that you cannot compel a passcode because it is testimonial statements. So, you know, for not to be sitting there asking him interrogation questions, but technically it still fits into that realm, if that answers your question. The respondent cited to several cases that dealt with the theory of, you know, different theories that I would like to address. There was one that dealt with the theory of foregone conclusion, and that's United States v. Apple Mac Pro, in which the Third Circuit held that decryption prior order may have been testimonial but was not a violation because the officers already knew it was on the computer. But here, the officers had no idea that there was a recorded phone calls on that phone. They expected to find maybe a call log, some text messages, images, or social media. But that was kind of a total surprise and jackpot to find these recorded phone calls. As far as the inevitable discovery, we mentioned that. We also believe that you know, there was no indication that they would have been able to break the passcode and that taping was not legal. The respondent also argued that the request for the passcode was similar to a consent to search. That case is cited dealt with Fourth Amendment violations, and we did not argue that it was a Fourth Amendment violation. The issue deals with Mr. Mickelson's Fifth Amendment rights. And the U.S. Supreme Court in Schlegelmoth v. Boston Mental in 1973, they stated that Miranda applies to the essence of a fair trial, whereas Fourth Amendment searches apply to the right to privacy and to be left alone. The respondent also argued in United States v. Paintain that a Miranda violation doesn't necessarily mean that the evidence will be excluded. As compared to that case, Mr. Mickelson had already requested counsel, unlike Mr. Paintain, and the phone is more personal than the gun was in that case. As stated in Riley v. California, the phone is a tidy computer with immense storage capacity for private details of a person's life.
Mr. Sono?
Yes.
This is Justice Hardesty. Can you hear me?
I can, very well.
Good, thank you. Sorry to interrupt your train of thought, but I did want to pose a question. I understand that your argument here focuses on the Fifth Amendment, and you're not raising a Fourth Amendment challenge, but if the court evaluates these two events separately, and I'm really interested in knowing why we shouldn't. One event, of course, is the question of seeking access to the passcode, and then entirely separately, in essentially plain sight, he inserts the passcode, and that is recorded on a body cam. In evaluating these matters, especially given the dearth of law, why shouldn't the court evaluate each of these interactions with law enforcement separately?
Go ahead, I'm sorry. No, the court can do that, certainly. We didn't raise it, but, you know, as the court recently said in Betchel, the court has the right to sua sponte raise something that they feel is important to the case, whether or not it was raised or not. So if the court feels that that is a Fourth Amendment argument that we missed, certainly we're not going to object that you raise that.
Well, if we did treat that second interaction as governed by the Fourth Amendment, then if you apply Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, wouldn't the, whether it's inevitable discovery or plain sight, I mean, where is the Fourth Amendment violation? That's what I'm trying to understand. He's in the presence of the officers. He's engaging in an activity that is in their plain sight. I don't quite understand what Fourth Amendment violation has occurred if we were to look at that separately.
You know, I think that because the state did argue that in a Fourth Amendment sort of way on their response, I think they might be the proper person to ask as to how they see that as a Fourth Amendment violation. I still kind of picture that as a cat out of the bag scenario where you know, that it should be, it's kind of a fruit of a legal search or a legal act and violation that, you know, he had already given him the code. And therefore, when it's out there in plain sight, he you know, it was kind of too late to be able to analyze that, whether it should be legal
well,
or not. But
does the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine apply to a Fifth Amendment violation? I'm not so sure that that's correct, is it?
Well, I think a cat out of the bag analysis does, where people are, they're not properly Mirandized, and then they confess to something, and then they give them the Miranda rights, and then they confess again because the cat's already out of the bag. I think that's sort of what the argument I was kind of searching for at that point, or alluding to.
So. Okay, thank you.
Well, so Ms. DeSoto, if I could follow up on that,
sure.
Then even if we were to agree with you that it was a Fifth Amendment violation to ask for the passcode and get it, doesn't that just warrant suppressing the passcode rather than the search of the phone that came later, which was with a warrant?
I don't know if we had any arguments that you know, once they got a warrant, except for the general warrant argument, that could prevent
right.
a search of the phone.
Okay.
They could.
So the remedy for the alleged Fifth Amendment violation that you're arguing is just there can't be testimony that he told them the passcode?
No, absolutely not. We felt that the phone call should not have come in. That the passcode was not readily available, and we don't know that they would have inevitably found it if he hadn't given it to them. So, you know, certainly if we had been there advising him, we would have advised him not to give them the passcode, and I think that is a violation where you know, the whole, you know, everything is excluded under the, you know, and I know that they were arguing that under Pantane that that's not necessarily excluded under the Fifth Amendment, but we would argue just the opposite, that it would be.
All right, you're at 222.
Okay, we also argued the general warrant and that warrants should be particularly described, the things that are to be seized. And the officers could not describe the recorded phone calls on the telephone in this case because they didn't know they existed. The warrant in this case sought text messages, call logs, and images, and then it added this catch-all phrase of any method, other method of transmitted or received communication not previously named, and that sort of enclosed everything. Like I said, it's the catch-all phrase. So they went on this fishing expedition as soon as they got into the phone. When we compare this to Stanford v. Texas, where the list included all possible materials concerning the Communist Party, it's not that much different. We also argued that bifurcation of the enhancement evidence, that it should have been bifurcated in this court, Gonzales v. State, you state where failure to bifurcate it compromises the defendant's right for a fair trial, bifurcation is mandatory. And in the present case, the evidence of the 10 telephone calls was offered to the jury over and over. The prosecutor opened their opening statement with those phone calls. They mentioned it over and over in the closing statement. If you were in the courtroom and you watched the jury's facial expressions when they played those phone calls, it was certainly that they had made up their minds of guilt at that moment. As for the flight instruction, there was no evidence of flight in this case. Both parties were afraid, and by using the flight instruction, we felt that the district attorney was able to use Mr. Michelson's assertion of his right to consult with counsel against him.
Did you say your client was afraid?
Well, supposedly, yes. That's what he claimed, is that he was afraid.
There's no evidence of any weapons in the other vehicle, is there?
No, there's no evidence of other weapons in the other vehicle. He stated they tried to run him off the road. That's what his claim was. And that he was certainly afraid, and then he wanted to consult with counsel. Is there any other questions?
You've got 12 seconds left for your rebuttal. Thanks.
Oh, I used my 2 minutes?
No, I indicated 2:22 is what you had left.
Thank you. Okay.
Thanks. All right. Ms. Branningham?
And may I remove the mask as well?
Yes, yes.
All right, good morning. May it please the court, my name is Melanie Brantingham. I am a deputy district attorney in the Carson City District Attorney's Office, appearing on behalf of the respondent in this case, the state of Nevada. In his appeal, the appellant asks this court to find that the district court erred in four different ways. First, in denying the motion to suppress based upon claims of a general warrant. Second, in denying the motion to suppress based upon a claimed Miranda violation. Third, in denying the motion to bifurcate the hate crime enhancement from the guilt phase of the trial. And fourth, in giving a flight instruction to the jury. I'll address the Miranda issue first. On this issue, the appellant asks this court to draw an unworkable distinction. And that is to recognize, on the one hand, the law regarding consent to search, and that an officer has the authority to ask an in-custody suspect for consent to search without giving Miranda warnings, but then to find that it is a violation of Miranda for that same officer to ask that same suspect for the tool to access the item that he's been given permission to search. Appellant's request is not supported by the law, and the district court did not err in recognizing that no Miranda violation occurred in this case. The claim as set forth in the appellant's opening brief is that Sergeant Acosta engaged in unlawful custodial interrogation when he asked the appellant, who was in custody, for the passcode to his phone without reading Miranda. While the appellant calls this a Fifth Amendment violation, the context of the argument reveals that the claim is actually that Miranda, not the Fifth Amendment, was violated. The two are not synonymous. They're different analyses under the law. So first, in order for Miranda warnings to be triggered, you must have two things. You must have custody, and you must have interrogation. In this case, the state acknowledges that the appellant was in custody. We don't dispute that. But he was not subjected to interrogation. Interrogation, by definition, is questioning initiated by law enforcement designed to elicit incriminating information. That didn't happen here. The question that was asked was simply, can I have the passcode to your phone so that I can put it in airplane mode to preserve it? Appellant consented to that request, and he entered the passcode into the phone. He did it himself. It was a drawing passcode, not a series of numbers or anything like that. So the appellant drew the passcode into his phone himself, consenting to that request of the officer.
Sorry, I just want to make sure I understood that, Ms. Branningham. So at the time of the question that defense is objecting to, when he asked for the passcode, what actually happened is Mr. Michelson took the phone and drew the pattern on the phone himself. He didn't say it out loud to the police.
That's accurate. He input it himself with his finger.
Thank you.
The question was not an interrogation. There's nothing inherently incriminating about disclosing the passcode to the phone, nor was the sergeant seeking any incriminating information. He was only asking to access the phone for a limited purpose, which was to preserve the phone by placing it in airplane mode. The act of inputting the code told Sergeant Acosta nothing about the contents of the phone, and in this case, told Sergeant Acosta nothing more than he already knew, which was that appellant had control over the phone. He'd seen appellant on the phone talking to dispatch while he was standing outside the house observing the scene. The phone was in Mr. Michelson's pocket when he was taken into custody. And in addition to that, he was actually on the phone with Sergeant Acosta, Mr. Michelson was, when he came out of the house to surrender. As opposing counsel mentioned, the bulk of the authority that deals with these sort of questions about the implication of the Fifth Amendment disclosure of a cell phone passcode is not found in the situation we have here, which is a voluntary disclosure. It's found in the context of compelled disclosures, where the government in some form or fashion orders a defendant to disclose a passcode to a cell phone, an encryption, a de-encryption device for a computer. There's some compulsory process to get the defendant to provide that information. The analysis, the manner of disclosure in those cases is a little bit different, but I think the analysis is helpful. So in the compelled disclosure situations, where the disclosure tells the government no more than it already knows, there is no constitutional violation that occurs in forcing the defendant to reveal the information. That's in a forced situation, not a voluntary situation like we have here. And that is the foregone conclusion doctrine. That doctrine does come from the Fisher case. And the Massachusetts Supreme Court case that we cited in our brief gives a good analysis of how that doctrine applies in this context with the disclosure of a cell phone password. There is no constitutional violation under that doctrine, the foregone conclusion doctrine, where the government establishes, one, that it knows the existence and location of the evidence, and two, that the defendant possesses and controls the evidence, and three, that it's authentic. So for cell phones, then, that Massachusetts case talks about requiring the government to show that it knew the existence of the electronic device and knew that the defendant had possession or control of it. And when proof of those elements has been met, the government can compel a defendant to provide the passcode, because it is a foregone conclusion, then, that he knows the passcode. So that's the analysis. Now, if those factors are sufficient proof to compel a defendant to disclose the passcode, then it certainly must be sufficient to allow a government agent to ask him in a voluntary setting to provide the passcode, even absent Miranda warnings. When we look at the circumstances under which the request for the passcode was made here, those circumstances demonstrate that the request for the passcode was not an interrogation. In analyzing what occurred, Sergeant Acosta's actions requesting the passcode most closely resemble a request for a consent to search for which no Miranda warnings are required. That no Miranda warnings are required when requesting consent to search is undisputed. The reason that the courts have held those warnings aren't required is that giving consent to search is not the sort of testimonial act that the Fifth Amendment was designed to protect. And here, the sergeant fully informed the appellant of what he wanted, which was access to the phone using the passcode. Not only what he wanted, but why he wanted it, which was to preserve the phone and its contents, indicating that they may later seek a search warrant for that phone. With that full knowledge in mind, Mr. Michelson consented to provide the passcode and allow the limited scope access to his phone. At its most basic level, then, this is a limited scope consent search, not an interrogation. Applying the law and facts of this case in this context, if you follow the logic that appellant argues for in its brief, then Sergeant Acosta could have asked appellant on scene to search his phone, "Can I search the entire contents of your phone?" And the appellant could have consented to that. "Yes, you can search my phone." with no Miranda warnings required. Now, this is a much more invasive process, much more invasive request than what Sergeant Acosta actually asked for. But then extending that logic, following it to the next step, what appellant is asking you to do is to say that Sergeant Acosta could not then say, okay, Mr. Michelson, you've allowed us to search this phone. May we please have the passcode to get into it without stopping and Mirandizing him to gain that tool to access the object that he'd consented to search. It's an untenable position. There was no Miranda violation here. There was no constitutional violation. Mr. Michelson was not in any form or fashion compelled to incriminate himself. Now, I do want to address the argument about the fruit of the poisonous tree. So even if this court does find for some reason that Miranda warnings were required, that doesn't end the analysis. Then the analysis becomes, if Miranda warnings were required and they weren't given and an unwarned statement was made, what is the remedy? Well, the Patain case tells us very clearly, when an unwarned statement is made, so long as it's voluntary, then the remedy, the complete remedy for that error, is suppression of the statement at trial. It's a complete remedy. The remedy is not to go beyond that and suppress any physical or other evidence that's gained thereby. So in this particular case, if the court finds that the Miranda warning should have been given prior to the statement being made, and that Sergeant Acosta didn't do that, the remedy is to suppress that particular line of questioning at trial. In this case, reviewing the trial transcript, the state did not seek to introduce any testimony regarding how Sergeant Acosta accessed the phone on scene. The state did not ask for Mr. Michelson's information to be testified to at trial. It only asked Sergeant Acosta how he accessed the phone, and his response was that he input the passcode to place the phone in airplane mode. And so to the degree that any suppression of that statement would have been appropriate, there's no effect here in this case because it didn't impact the trial at all. The state did not seek to introduce that evidence at trial. In fact, the only reference to Mr. Michelson inputting the passcode was brought up by defense counsel in cross-examination of Sergeant Acosta in the vein of covering that Mr. Michelson was cooperative with Sergeant Acosta during the investigation and the process there outside his house. Going beyond the Miranda issue to the constitutional issue, the Fifth Amendment issue, if this court concludes that some constitutional violation occurred in asking Mr. Michelson to produce his passcode, then the court should look at whether there is another mechanism under which that evidence would have come in, being the contents of the cell phone. So that's the inevitable discovery rule. So addressing inevitable discovery, if the court finds a violation occurred in obtaining evidence, that evidence still comes in at trial if it would have inevitably been found. And in this particular case, the state's position is that it absolutely would have inevitably been discovered when Mr. Michelson himself requested his phone back from the officers so that he could get into it, so that he could obtain some telephone numbers to provide to his wife before the phone was taken. Sergeant Acosta complied with that request, and as this court indicated, in plain view of Sergeant Acosta and his body camera, which I'll address just briefly, the body camera recording, there's nothing unlawful about that. Our officers are actually now required to wear body cameras in their interactions to record those interactions. So there's nothing unlawful about that recording of the interaction. In fact, it's now mandated. But Sergeant Acosta then is able to observe Mr. Michelson on approximately four occasions, which is also captured on body camera, input that passcode into the phone. So it is then inevitably discovered through plain view or other lawful means while he is standing there with Mr. Michelson.
Counsel, this is Justice Hardesty. I apologize for interrupting you, and I'm not able to determine how much time you have left. My screen with respect to that does not show what time you have remaining. So I'd like to ask you to shift gears, if you don't mind, to the argument made by Michelson that the warrant in this case was not particularized, and whether it meets the TC or versus state requirement for particularization of the search of the cell phone.
Yes, Your Honor. In our brief, we indicated that, in fact, this was not a general warrant. So the issue is, was there specificity in the location to be searched and the items to be seized? And in this case, the warrant was sufficiently particular. The cell phone, which is the location to be served, to be searched, excuse me, was identified by make, by model, by serial number, and by location. So there's specificity as to the item to be searched, the location to be searched. As for the items to be seized, those were also specific in that the officer said, we're looking for communications. We're looking for communications related to the incident and appellant's motive for his behavior. And we described those as call logs, text messages, or other communications, and that those were specifically related to the incident or his motive for his behavior. We're dealing with a cell phone, which is emerging technology. And so from that standpoint, the officer could not be more specific about the actual file structure because it's an unknown. Those forensic downloads of those phones have to be performed in order for the exact file structure to be identified. But he did specifically identify such that anybody could determine whether there was probable cause to believe that it was evidence or that they were coming upon the items that they were given permission to search by saying we're looking
for... Ms. Brenningham, I just need to get a question in real quick. Was the affidavit in support of the search warrant attached to the search warrant?
It was.
Thank you.
And Ms. Brenningham, to give you adequate time to address Justice Hardesty's question and follow, I'm going to give you two additional minutes. I'll extend two additional minutes to Ms. DeSoto, too, for rebuttal.
Thank you. The case that we cited in our brief was U.S. versus Spilotra, which in dealing with specificity says the description must be specific enough to enable the person conducting the search to identify the things to be seized, and that generic categories of items are not necessarily invalid if a more precise description is not possible. So you have to show that there was probable cause to seize the items of the type described, which there was, the evidence of the communications related to the shooting and his motive for the shooting, the objective standards by which the officers can differentiate. Here they're looking for evidence of communications related to the shooting versus any other sort of communications, right? So they could determine, is this communication related to Mr. Michelson shooting at this car, or was it a conversation with his wife about groceries? We can make that distinction. So it's sufficiently particular there. And as for the ability to describe it more particularly, as I indicated, oftentimes with cell phone technology, that's just not possible. We don't know what those internal file structures look like until you're actually doing the download of the phone. But the support was there. The particularity of the items to be seized was there. And the only authority cited by the appellant on this issue is a non-search warrant case. And that's the Walter case that talks about the government needing to have a search warrant before it engages in some sort of a generalized search. In that case, it was films. And so it doesn't really have any application in this context. But from the state's
counsel, if I could interrupt you, please, this is Justice Hardesty. I'd like to get your reaction to this. There is some research and some articles that suggest that in the context of the unique context, I should say, of cell phone searches, and given the kinds of data and information that can be stored on digital files, that perhaps in that situation there should be some screening mechanism, an intermediate step, so to speak, where the officers sort through the digital files and determine what are relevant and then specify a second warrant identifying what communications within the phone they should be allowed to search. I acknowledge that that sounds cumbersome to me, but I wanted to get your reaction because there apparently is a case that out of the Tenth Circuit that recognizes that approach.
I think that would be difficult for officers to do as a practical matter because once they have those contents of the phone, then their eyes were open to the entire contents of the phone. I suppose they could then go to back to the district court and say, we want permission to seize certain pieces of those files. But in terms of actually authorizing a search, I think the court has to authorize the search of the entire contents and then limit what's relevant. It would be like saying, okay, we can go into a house to search for, let's say we're going into a house to search for drugs, but then we get in there and we've got to kind of look around and see if there's drugs and then go back to the court and say, okay, we found some drugs. There's some methamphetamine, some marijuana, some heroin. But now we want a search warrant to seize methamphetamine, marijuana, and heroin. Well, they'd already be covered by that original search warrant, would be my position.
All right.
Thank you.
Colleagues, any additional questions for Ms. Brandingham?
Nope.
No, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. DeSoto?
You know, I did want to address Justice Hardesty's analysis of that Tenth Circuit case. And certainly under, you know, California v. Riley, with the amount of private evidence or private information that is available on a telephone, that is certainly something that should be looked into, that you can go into it and analyze what information is just not relevant at all.
So, Ms. DeSoto, if I could interrupt you, I yes. wanted to pose this question to you before, and we kind of ran out of time, but thanks to Justice Berrigeri, we get a chance to have this exchange. What test would you offer for the court's consideration when evaluating what information can be seized from a cell phone? Not necessarily searched. They're already there, and they've got it, and they've opened it. But now the question is, what test should be employed with respect to a seizure of any information?
That's a really good question, and I just don't know how to answer it at this point. I think I'd have to think about that for a little while. That seems like I mentioned, you're opening a whole world of private information and to consider, you know, the kinds of things that can be seized at that point. Certainly, you know, we had the
let's just take this case here, this did not happen. This is a hypothetical, so I don't want the record to suggest that this happened. But
okay.
Suppose that the officers in conducting the search discover on Mr. Michelson's phone a whole bunch of pornography or child pornography photographs. What then?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Because normally when you would do a search and you find those things, I don't know if they're stopped from actually seeking some kind of charges on that. I don't know the answer to that question, Justice Hardesty. I'm sorry. I did want to mention with Justice Katus, she mentioned that he did not say it out loud as to the combination. He put it in himself. That's still coming out of his mind, and I think that's still considered testimonial as far as that goes. But even though he did not speak the words because it was a combination that was a symbol on his phone, I think it still qualifies under the analysis as testimonial. Is there any other questions that the panel
colleagues, have? Any other questions?
No.
All right, very good.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for the good briefing and the arguments today. This matter will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess until 11.